Welcome back to American Classroom, Stories of Building a Civil Society. I'm Lindsay Lundeen Crosland, here with co-host Jared Taylor. And on this podcast, we explore the people and ideas shaping the future of education, creativity, and character in America. Today's guest is someone who embodies all three, creativity, character, and commitment to learning, in a way that's truly remarkable. We're honored to welcome Ben Sowards to the show. Ben is a nationally recognized artist, a professor at Southern Utah University, and an artistic infusion program designer for the U.S. Mint. Yes, those coins in your pocket might just carry his work. He's known for breathing emotion and imagination into both classical and contemporary visual art. In addition to his work for the U.S. Mint, Ben has done artwork for worldwide religious organizations and illustrated numerous books. His commissioned portraits and paintings are held in both public and private collections around the world. Beyond his professional accomplishments, Ben is a proud father of 12 children, a fact that makes him not only an artist and educator, but a full-time mentor, guide, and storyteller in the most personal way possible. On today's show, which is the first episode of season two, we will discuss the power of creativity in education, explore how art shapes character, memory, and learning, plus the role of mentorship, technology, and personal storytelling in developing young artists. Ben, welcome to American Classroom.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
So you're joining us from Cedar City?
Yes.
Utah. Okay. You tell us a little bit about Southern University of Utah. And
I'm joining you from my office here at Southern Utah University, where I've taught since 2001. It's been a little bit of time looking back. I teach classes in the area of painting and drawing and illustration.
What's your favorite to teach?
Painting. Portrait painting. Yeah. But I enjoy it all. It's a great place to work and to be an educator and an artist.
Ben, in preparation for this, Lindsay sent a couple links, and I was looking at your portrait page on your website, and I noticed all the beautiful portraits, but then there was one with four little girls in bed. And that one, I'd love to hear the background of that. I'm a girl dad. I've got three girls, and it took me right back to when my three girls were little, and they loved to just lay in bed together and giggle and talk. I was like, I got to hear the story behind that if you have a minute.
Yeah. So, I mean, for me, as a dad, as you know, one of my great highs is knowing my kids' bellies are full and like they're asleep. Like, they're wonderful when they're awake. Love them when they're awake, but when they're asleep, there's something just very sweet about the potentiality that's there in their stillness, their all of their goodness and infinite potential is all just kind of like still there for a moment. And I had done a couple paintings about this when I was approached by this client who had four daughters and wanted to commission a portrait. And so what we did is we played with the idea of falling asleep. And so these girls, we arranged them and got them to go to sleep. And then just kind of, as you can do with kids, you move them while they're asleep and just kind of arrange things. And I got up above them on a balcony and photographed them and did the painting from that perspective. So it's supposed to be a little bit of a, you know, two things happening at once in this painting, that they're still, but they're in motion.
That's neat. Yeah. Thanks for sharing that. That's great.
Thanks. I'm glad you enjoyed it.
You also in your gallery, you have some early American figures there. Do you want to talk to a little bit about how you got interested in doing those pieces?
Yeah, I've been interested in the founding of our country and the founding fathers from a very, very young age. It was a dinner time topic for my family growing up. We talked politics around the table a lot in history, and just an area that interested me. So I have drawings of, you know, Abe Lincoln and George Washington in particular, going back to when I was 6 and 7 years old.
Wow.
Just always enjoyed it. I was able to travel a lot as a child with my father's business. And so we ended up in a lot of historical places as well. And so I got to be exposed to those ideas at a really young age. Later in life, I had some opportunities to work with Chris Stewart, who later became a congressman from Utah here. I'm in our second congressional district. He had written a book called Seven Miracles That Saved America. And I love that book. I'd already worked with him in the past. And so I approached him about creating a illustrated book with those same stories because I wanted to be able to share those stories with my children. And so that's those paintings you're looking at come from that project. One thing that happened that was really cool is I was able to take my then 9-year-old daughter, who's just starting law school now, back with me on a trip to Washington, D.C. and Gettysburg and Philadelphia and the East River, New York, and all the places that are depicted in that book, and have that special kind of like connection with her and with that project, which is what I dreamed of when I proposed the project to Chris, is that I would have the opportunity to teach these stories to my children.
Ben, I'd be interested in your perspective as a college professor. You see a lot of the young people that come up from the K-12 environment that Lindsay and I are in. What do you think is good and what do you think is lacking in art education, in K-12 right now from what you're seeing coming into your classroom?
Well, most of my students come from the K-12 system here in Utah, where there's quite a lot of investment in the arts. I feel like they have a well-rounded exposure and instruction. Let me put it this way. I feel like the student artists that I work with that are going to eventually make it a career are very intrinsically driven. They will not be stopped. They will create regardless. And those are really the students that I see reaching their potential. So it's so much easier for me to engage students that have had a well-rounded art education in K-12 because they have context, they understand some of the historical events, and they've been exposed to a variety of medium. And so that makes it a lot easier to take what they bring and then challenge them. I like to think of my favorite student as a velocity student, someone who's working really hard in their own practice. They're working in their sketchbook, they're exploring materials, they're the kids that are writing on the walls everywhere in their life, right? And I think of them as ricochet students. So they're traveling at high velocity, and my job is to just kind of like reflect them, ricochet them in one direction or another to help them get on course. But that's my favorite kind of student.
Yeah, that's powerful. I like that you use the word velocity. That's something I've thought about lately. In fact, right now I'm right in the middle of this really long biography of Bach. And they talk about how he got to this point in his creative, it was early in his career. He went from city to city and with all these organs, he was playing the organ. And there was a point that in physics, we call it escape velocity, but he knew every pipe and the effect of every stop on every pipe. And he knew so much about music. The sky was, there was no limits for him. He had reached that virtuoso or escape velocity, right? Where you break the pull of gravity. That's the physics concept. And it's interesting in the artist world, when an artist breaks through that. And I liked how you talked about that because that's achievable for a lot of people. That virtuoso level in music, or I'm not sure what the equivalent is in your space, but we try to do that because I love the point you made as well, that people are creators. Sometimes they actually have a class to go to and sometimes they don't. and you can build on that. It's pretty powerful.
One of the things that I find to be absolutely essential for a good student is someone who's putting in the hours. So I love your example of escape velocity. I think that's a perfect way to explain it, because there is a point, and I remember exactly when this happened for me, whenever you've been working in kind of a journeyman way, you're mixing the colors according to formulas you've learned, or you're applying paint in an order according to a method that you've been shown by a mentor. And then there's a point where all of a sudden you're creating without thought, without conscious thought, without a formulaic approach to what you're doing, and you're in the flow state and you're just able to create. And that's something that doesn't happen for a long time. I mean, the 10,000 hour theory is, I think, very relevant there.
Yeah, that's great. And people, I remember listening to an author talk about how do you get through that escape velocity breakout. And he used a lot of four-letter words, but his basic thing was just go, just try. And like you said, the sketchbook, just get working, just start writing, and for his face. And you'll get there. Be patient with yourself, just write. And someone asked an old whittler years ago, how do you get so good at whittling? He said, start making some chips. Just get going.
Put miles in your pencil, right?
Yeah, like, miles in your pencil.
You're all the lines and all the drawing you'll ever do is one continuous line, right?
Mm-hmm.
Through time, you have to imagine it. And there's no way to get your pencil from this point to this point without moving along that line. So you have to draw, you have to create in order to build that competency. Mm-hmm. There's no other way to do it.
Mm-hmm. When did you know that you were going to have a career out of art in this space? What, tell us the origin story.
Well, I believed I was going to be an artist when I was very, very young.
Oh, in really? Fact, oh, wow.
If you look at my website in the about section, you'll see an eagle. That is an eagle that I drew when I was 4 years old. My dad took it to work with him and showed his employees. And I remember thinking to myself, like, my dad's at work and the adults are discussing my painting, you know, my drawing, and really, really crazy,
gallery.
Right? Right. But I mean, I think there it takes a little bit of disconnect to believe you can be an artist and to believe that the world needs you to be an artist, which is a whole nother thing, right? Like, that of all the people that have ever lived, like, and all the images ever created, that the world needs me to create more. That's a, very, that takes a lot of hubris to believe that.
Yeah.
And I believed it. And I was very serious about it. And so serious that I convinced my mom to let me drop out of preschool. And I was in preschool so that I could draw more and didn't have to do so many ridiculous macaroni crafts.
Can we get beyond the macaroni?
Right. And so I just, throughout my life, like, continued, I made deals with teachers. I had a wonderful third grade teacher who allowed me to do my work a month in advance. And then I would sit in the back of the classroom and she would allow me to get art supplies and books. And I would just draw back there and listen to class like an audiobook for the remainder of the month. It occurred to me at that point that third grade wasn't all that hard. You could do it in the weekend for the month. If you just put your mind to it, right, you could do all the work. And she was wonderful to have that sort of like insight to know that that's what I needed. But just more experiences like that as I went. I really didn't have a high school art opportunity, but I was able to find private lessons and other mentors to help me along my path.
No, that's great. So for a young person that is aspiring, you know, they have aspirations, they'd like to be good at art, but every time they put something down in their sketchbook, they feel like a failure. What advice would you give them to continue on, or, you know, continue to develop their skills?
I would say that, like, okay, when I was a kid, we traveled around the country for my dad's business. And when we had downtime, he would call, look in the yellow pages for an artist, and he would call and ask if I could come to his studio or her studio. And I got a lot of studio visits when I was a kid. And that really helped me because it let me see, oh, here's a real person who's doing real art for a career. Now we have that opportunity at our fingertips, on our devices, right? Any kid can sit and look at thousands of artists who are really making it. That's awesome. But I also think it's dangerous, because what happens is you compare what you're doing right now in your sketchbook to that incredible work you're seeing out there. And there's this divide that's so uncrossable, right? They feel discouraged. I think I would say find a few mentors, whether in real life, which are better, or virtual mentors online, and look at what you love and follow that, what you're loving, but keep your nose down and draw. Because what would happen to me is I would go and visit and leave, and then I would work on my own, and I would forget how good this artist was, right? And I would begin to believe that I could be that good, even though what I was doing looked childish. So I would just say, you know, keep your nose down and know that what you're looking at in an artist's portfolio is very rarely representative of their struggle and their work. One of the reasons why I like to put that eagle on our website, and one reason is when I graduated from college with my undergraduate degree in art, my dad gave that to me at my graduation. He took it out of his wallet and gave it to me.
Oh, fun.
Yeah, it was really awesome. And I've got it right here.
Oh, there it is. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's great.
In my office. Is that you have to work and know that everybody started making just scribbles on a paper. No matter how talented someone looks now or achieved they look now, everyone went through the same path. Or made the same elevation change on the way up the mountain. Some people have an easier road than others do, but it's the same mountain for everyone. And you've got to just keep putting your pencil down and going and going and going until you get there. So I think it's never been easier to be awesome or to develop your skills as an artist, because you've got so many resources available to you now. You can visit any museum virtually. You can see any piece of work that's ever been done. So many artists are posting tutorials. And art supplies are cheaper than they were. I feel like they're more available. But I think it's a great time to be an artist.
It really is. To use a phrase that's been, it may be a golden age for art.
Yeah, it might be.
Yeah. It's interesting how you say things are more accessible. But I think that's profound what you're talking about, is they've all gone through the S curve. You know, the struggle, the trial, and then they hit the curve and they're like, wow, I might actually draw something. Yeah.
And Bach started just hitting the piano, right? And obviously some people are going to be naturally more gifted in a certain area, but we all have our gifts. Lean into your gift, whatever your gift is. There's a quote that I absolutely love from a book that I recommend to any artist. I love it, called Art and Fear by David Bales and Ted Orland, right here. I'm just going to, can I share it with you real quick? It's just
please,
a few sentences.
Please, yeah.
He says, but the important point here is not that you have or don't have what other artists have, but rather it doesn't matter. Whatever they have is something needed to do their work. It wouldn't help you in your work even if you had it. Their magic is theirs. You don't lack it. You don't need it. It has nothing to do with you. And I think that understanding that each of us has a unique gift as an individual to contribute to this world. Some of us contribute in a visually creative way. That's a very small niche of people that are going to contribute this way. If that's your calling and that's your gift, lean into it and know that like your creative gift is going to look a little different than somebody else's. We didn't need two Bachs. We needed a Bach and a Beethoven.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And a Mozart. So the same thing's true with artists. Each one is needed if they'll believe in themselves and invest in themselves in a way that respects their gift.
Takes it to the next level, or adds a whole new dimension of it. Yeah, I think that's powerful. I think young people really need to do that. Even though sometimes early on, when we think about the maturation of an artist, and I'll look at it from a music standpoint. You know, you copy Bach a little bit. You kind of get the rhythms and the tones.
Oh yeah.
the beats, and or Miles Davis if you're a jazz person, right? Get some of those patterns down. And then you say, okay, how do I put that into my voice? Or my horn or my pencil or whatever your medium is. And go do something cool. Go do something fun.
I think what you're saying is so important and often overlooked in the visual arts. For some reason, we follow recipes to learn the culinary arts. We play pieces to learn the piano or to learn jazz or whatever. But in art, a lot of times we tell people, oh, you can't be derivative. You cannot copy someone's work. You can't hold yourself to a standard. And I feel exactly the opposite. I actually assign my students to copy work because I feel like it's only in playing Bach and then listening to someone else play Bach that you can truly judge where the gap is for you and improve. And the same thing's true with art. Only by drawing things that are known or that are understood can you start to see some of that gap. And so really, really strongly believe that's important, the visual artist as well.
Yeah. I used to wonder, why are they always painting an apple or fruit? You know, because we have art galleries that are outside our musicals. So when people come to our musicals, first thing they do while they're waiting is they go look at the art gallery from the semester's work. I think it's a really interesting thing. I used to wonder, like, why are they always painting fruit? You know, do they really like fruit around this school? But, you know, you got to get the basics down, right? Then you see light, color, right, and things like that. So,
and there are so many paintings of fruit. You should be able to look at yours and look at everyone else's and go, well, does mine look as delicious, right? Does mine look as evocative of what a fruit is?
Yeah. Well, I noticed the orange on your website.
Yeah.
And it took me back because I was raised on an acre, little small farm. We had farm animals, but my dad loved trees and we had probably 20 or 30 fruit trees. And I ate oranges all the time. I had terrible allergies, so the pollen just drove me crazy, but I suffered through it because the oranges were so delicious. And I saw those oranges and it took me right back. It's one of those ratatouille moments. But
that's
yeah.
The tragedy of that orange is that it was never eaten because it dried up as I painted it.
Oh.
And when I was done, it was like, well, it sacrificed itself for a virtual experience for all of us.
There we go.
So
the orange he's referencing was that, I didn't see the image, but I'm assuming was that for the cover of Christmas Oranges?
Yeah, it was for the one of the interior illustrations for that. Yeah.
Oh.
So that metaphorically, that's a beautiful painting about light coming in on a full spectrum and refracting through the orange and coming out in a pure single band of color. Kind of the way that we, you know, reflect the light around us and it comes through us as a prism. We reflect it back to others through friendship and in our own unique way.
Oh, so. Oh, that makes sense. Because there is a lot of light on that top piece of your orange.
Yeah.
Yeah, I see that. Yeah, art's a great thing. In fact, just this year, we have our art teacher that he put a big mural up as a way to commemorate the 30th anniversary. And Lindsay knows that I'm terrible at art. I can't really draw it. Maybe one day, but we believe that the same idea that Jefferson had is if you want to perpetuate an idea through the generations, embed it in architecture. And she also knows that when we build a new school, and Lindsay's been really key at helping us build new schools, one of the things we do is, okay, what's the art package that's going to go in there? What do we want these walls to be speaking to these young people just tacitly as they pass by, helping them know who they can be, what freedoms that are their heritage, how can they build good character? Anyway, so it's been fun to kind of...
I think it's phenomenal. And Jefferson's such a great example of someone who was so creative and explored his creativity in so many different ways. But really all the founding fathers were like that. If you look at their lives, they were all innovators. They were all, you know, visionaries. I think it, when it comes down to it, any artist, whether you're a musician or visual artist or a dancer or anything, it comes down to the ability to precognate, right? To see something or hear something or taste something that's there beforehand and have a ratatouille moment where those colors explode in your mind and you know what it'll be, and then to make it a reality.
Yeah, in the medium that you're really good at.
Whether it's a painting or a country, it's the same thing.
We always like to ask a little bit about AI. It's such a huge force right now in all aspects of society. How would you advise young aspiring artists or people that like to, you know, play around with the generative capabilities of AI to approach that in a way that you know, would help them develop as an artist?
Yeah, AI is so incredible in its ability to just make ideas. I think one of the great things about it is it creates in a way that an artist who's successful creates. What I mean is that to be an artist, you have to be willing to fail. You have to be willing to take this idea and put it together and turn it and orient it in a new way and bring in a third idea and know that 99% or more of your ideas are going to be a failure. I think what's hard for an amateur artist is that they think everything they do has to be great. A professional artist knows that almost nothing they do is great. They just have to do a lot of it. And with AI, you see the same model. You see, you know, six fingers and weird, you know, because it's not self-aware in the same way that we as human beings are, that in a way that self-awareness cripples us and holds us back from our full creative potential. So in that way, I think AI can be really inspiring, where we have an advantage as a sentient being is that we're able to, if we can allow ourselves to create and make a lot of bad stuff, we're going to be able to recognize the really good stuff and move that forward. The idea is that you fail early and cheaply, and you try to move your idea forward with as low a cost as possible. So, if an artist can use AI to help them to ideate, to help them to come up with new ideas, I think it's still incumbent upon the artist to use their own artistic taste to say, this was a good idea that I saw. This is a bad idea that I saw. This is an idea that I want to develop further. I have some fear that it's going to drastically change the professional market for some artistic fields, design and entertainment and things like that, where a lot of my friends work. But I don't think it's ever going to replace the human touch, the human understanding of what it is to be human, which is what art is about. Art is about taking something, abstracting it from the world around us, and then showing it to those around us in a way that creates meaning. And I feel like that's still an advantage we have as human beings.
Yeah, that's interesting. And I don't know if you've started to do this, but when I see like maybe a book cover art or a graphic on social media or something, I don't know why, but one of the first things I question is that real or is that an AI generated? meaning artificial, well, right? Did someone
videos,
actually
right?
take time to do that? Yeah. And I don't know why my brain is starting to think about that. And when I think about that, I ask myself, why do I think about that? Because I actually am thinking, well, it's probably cheaper if someone is just doing something on AI, but if someone really took the time to develop that on whatever medium it is, it probably has a lot more value in it. And I'm not sure why that's my initial response to that, why I'm looking at it from a valuation standpoint, but it is an interesting initial thought.
So for me, the foundation of my artistic philosophy is that art is the manifestation of intention. And I feel like as an artist, if I create something, if I just create a lot of things that are beautiful, but I don't understand what I'm doing, that's not really art either. And I don't know that what AI is doing is really art. I can see the value of it in our society as a commodity, a visual commodity. But I think that, you know, our skepticism that you expressed and our dismissiveness of AI over time, as it becomes more sophisticated, I think we're going to become more sophisticated viewers and more skeptical of its value. And I feel like the valuation of real human generated art is going to increase, not decrease.
I agree. I think that's, it's interesting how that's a thing now with generative, AI products.
I was going to ask about, like, do you feel like art is an important part of today's American classroom? Of course it is. And I think a lot of the things that you've said would demonstrate that. I know you said that students that are coming in have had a lot of exposure to art in the K-12 space. A lot of our audience is teachers and parents in the K-12. And so what do you see as the harm? Obviously, you have an interest as an art teacher that you have students who are prepared. But as a whole, across the U.S., what do you see would be the result if there's cuts in including art education in the K-12 classroom?
It's a good question. I feel like that creation, that precognition and creation, it overlaps so many other disciplines, from the language arts to engineering to science. It's all about pre-visualizing something and then creating a plan to test that theory, your hypothesis. I feel like when my hope is that if the arts fall victim to cuts, that other disciplines are able to integrate those creative ideas into their disciplines. I mean, you can give a creative writing assignment. I think that that's also artistic. I don't think that art, when we say art in school, sometimes we just mean visual arts. I think the arts encompass so much of what it means to think, that truly cutting art out of school would be catastrophic, because we just wouldn't have visionary thinkers, which is, I think, what the arts do. Even if you're not going to be a creative visual artist, learning to create and sketch and draw is super valuable. They have found that medical doctors who do life drawing are better diagnosticians, because they learn to be more acute with how they observe the human body. I feel like those sorts of parallel benefits are everywhere. And the same thing goes for every other field of study, whether it's mathematics or history, right? They all inform what we do.
And think how many bodies of knowledge are reliant on artwork. So just take geography as an example. That's an obvious, like, what would GIS and Google Maps be without someone first coming up with a map, the piece of art? In some ways, right? What would battle be like, right? What would medicine be like? I can't remember the name of the famous book that started drawing all the different muscles and bones, but it was like the standard.
Like Gray's Anatomy?
Gray's Anatomy, yeah. Gray's Anatomy, right. What would medicine be like? I mean, once Gray's Anatomy came out, it took that body of knowledge.
Well, now it's inspired by the work of Da Vinci and other Renaissance artists who were corpse robbing and then drawing.
Yeah, painfully.
I understand, yeah.
Okay, this is a question that I wanted to bring up. If a school doesn't offer a strong arts program, but you see potential in your child, and obviously, like, you had all kinds of experiences in your childhood, as you mentioned, and your parents were very supportive of your gift, and then you have, as a father, have raised children. So if a parent sees talent in their child, but the school doesn't support it, what are some ways that you recommend that a parent can support that at home?
Well, it's hard to imagine raising a child that loves to read with no books in their home, or that loves music without an instrument, a piano or a guitar or something, pots and pans, something to play with, right? It's hard to imagine somebody valuing physical fitness and health without having opportunities to move their bodies. The same thing's true of the arts. As a parent, I would just implore you to let your child explore and let your child create, let them destroy, let them fail. It's not important that what they're doing is good, quote unquote, according to your idea of what good is. I can't tell you, most of my students, and I'm not going to put a number on this, but it's a large majority, are at school as art majors despite their parents, which is so sad for me because I didn't have that experience. I had entrepreneurial type parents who were like, hey, yeah, do it. You're going to be awesome. You could totally do this if you want to. And, you know, it's maybe scary because we don't know people that make a living as an artist, but you know what? Do your homework, go out and talk to people. There are plenty of people in your community who are working as artists. It's the number one hobby, in the country is the visual arts, making work. One thing that's very interesting is that the overall job satisfaction of artists is extremely high. You hear of the tortured artists, and that's true. There's a lot of torturing that goes on with creation. But overall, people that major in art and are more likely to work in their field and more likely to be happy and satisfied with their work in their field, even if they're not making the most money of other college majors. So those are some statistics that I think really help in understanding that your child can become an artist and they can be happy. They can become extremely successful. They can become moderately successful. To me, the measure of success is, were you able to continue painting? Were you able to continue drawing? Were you able to continue working for years and decades through your life? If you're my age and you're still working, you've won, right? You're a winning artist because I'm still working. And if you can figure out a way to do that, and again, the models of how to do that are everywhere now and easily accessible to any parent. And so I would just say, you know, maybe that's your child's thing. Maybe it's your child's thing for a year or two. But even if it's your child's thing for a year or two, it's going to enhance and enrich their life forever, even if they don't do it professionally. The dinner time conversations we had about politics and history and the places I went as a child have enriched my life forever because I love studying history and I love bringing in that study of history into my artwork. Right? It's about whole life integration, and art could be a part of that for your child. And I would say encourage that.
I think today's higher ed makes it a little easier for people to, if parents are worried about, you're going to be an artist, you're not going to be able to make a lot of money. I think universities are making it a little easier to add a major or a double major or minor or things like that. So mom and dad could be safe. Okay, I've got a marketing dual major with an art degree. So do what you love, but also you can hedge it a little bit. But I love the parent who you can tell they're sitting at a music concert or in the theater, but he was the dude on the football team and she was the cheerleader, right? They are so out of their element, but they're supporting their child in what they're thriving on. And I love that. I love that scene because you can see that parent is highly invested. They know their child. They're not going to be the starting quarterback on the football team, but they are going to get the lead in the school play or thrive in one of the arts. I think that's just a fun part of our culture that we can see.
I feel like the artist that is a child that grows and becomes an artist, they will become an artist because they're unstoppable as an artist. I think of my students, part of my teaching philosophy is that, you know, we need certain elements to grow. But I think of my students as a handful of seeds. I can't tell you walking in the first day of class who's going to make it any more than I can tell you with a random assortment of seeds in my hand, which one is going to be an oak tree and which is going to be, a broccoli.
Yeah. Yeah.
So they're both wonderful. Mm-hmm. And not all of my students have to be artists. In fact, at the end of the year, I always give the speech. I say, hey, it's been wonderful having you in school this semester. This is a great time to examine your life. And if it's August and you're registering for classes again, and you haven't been drawing all summer or painting all summer or creating all summer long on your own time, maybe this isn't for you. Right? Because in order to make it in this field, it's highly competitive. It's you have to just love it, and you have to love it in spite of failure. So you have to be able to move forward even when people aren't loving your work. You have to make it anyway.
I love that we were talking earlier about what parents can do. And one thing I worry about is that it takes time to be still and quiet and with devices available, and you are looking on social media at different artists or whatever, but if they're constantly have a device in front of them, then how will they stop and take time to draw? I'm worried that like passions are replaced with distractions. And so I do think it's important for parents to just like have screen-free time and encourage them to develop their passions and not compare them to professionals, like you had mentioned. I also love that your dad stopped on road trips and went through the phone book and looked up studios and artists in the area. Like that, you know, it was such an example of supporting your child and their passions. And so I hope maybe that's a takeaway from this episode, is just some of your, you know, life examples.
And let me just say this too. I once was in a studio and I was showing my sketchbook, and I was probably 7. And he saw the eagles that I was drawing. So I was kind of obsessing over eagles, because you have one success, right? You want to repeat that. It's like the sequel, the sequel, the sequel. And but I love eagles. And it's so fun for me to get to put them on coins now. That's been such a thrill. But he actually went to his, they call it a morgue at the time. It was like his file cabinet where he kept the manila folders with all the images that he would cut out of magazines and stockpile in different categories. And he took out his Eagles folder and he gave it to me. And it had a few hundred Eagles in it. And I still have it, but he gave it to me. And what I'm saying is that there are a lot of good people out there, a lot of artists who would love to help your child. So don't ever hesitate to reach out. You don't have to reach out to the biggest names in New York City to get quality help. There are just so many people out there that want to have a human connection. Being an artist is kind of a solitary job. So when you're in your studio, you're all alone working by yourself. And sometimes you want a little bit of human connection. So you see it online, people sharing their work, sharing their process, creating tutorials, very generously giving of their time and efforts to help other people. But you can reach out one-on-one to an artist in your community, and I'll bet you'll have success.
That's awesome. You had mentioned coins. How did you get connected with the U.S. Mint? And do you want to talk a little bit about the coins you've done?
Yeah, I had a friend who had been working with them for a couple of years, and they had an open call for artists for the Artistic Infusion Program, which is a pool of about 25 artists that the United States Mint hires to design their coinage and metals in the United States. And so I applied, and it was a kind of a long process, and they had us do test designs, and they're anyway, and that was accepted. That was in 2015, I believe. So it's been about 10 years that I've been doing that. Almost done, sadly. 10 years is the limit. So, but
so do you work with the people in Philadelphia, or which mint?
All the creation of coins and metals is done in Philadelphia.
Oh, okay.
There are mints that manufacture the coins in San Francisco and Denver, and but the coins are all designed and engraved in Philadelphia.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Yeah. So the way it works is we submit designs. We're part of a pool of artists that they invite to submit designs, and then one is selected through various committees and the Secretary of the Treasury. And then that design is engraved by a United States Mint engraver. And so it's a collaborative work.
Wow.
They do all that in-house. So the
that's fun. What a fun project.
Oh, it's been like a thrill. Like every, you know, whenever I think about the fact that I get to actually do it. And, you know, I feel one of the things they said to us at our first orientation meeting that we had in Philadelphia was that coins are the number one collected souvenir of people visiting our country. And so when people come to America, you think what they're going to bring home with them, they're going to bring coins home with them. You do it when you visit a foreign country, you bring home some, you know, some renminbi or whatever. And then you show it off. And so a lot of times, like the reputation or the aesthetic touch of our country that's felt around the world is through our coinage. And that's why there are like congressionally appointed committees that oversee the design aesthetic and curate this American ideal in our coinage, because it matters to the way we're perceived around the world. So to me, it felt very patriotic. I never served in our military, but being a United States artistic infusion artist has been something I feel like has been a patriotic contribution that I felt very good about and very fulfilled by over the years. Yeah. And, you know, occasionally I get one back as change at the store if I ever use cash, and I thumb through the quarters real quick to see if I got one of mine, and if I did, it's a lucky day.
That's good. I like that. Yeah.
Are you allowed to talk about the presidential medals you've designed, or about like Congressional Medal of Honor that is being unveiled next week, or any of that stuff?
Sure. So in 20, every president that serves receives a medal for their service from the United States Mint. This goes back to George Washington all the way through every presidential term. In fact, so at the end of Trump's first term, I was invited to submit designs for his presidential medal. And he and his family selected my portrait of him for his medal, which was really exciting. I even got a few notes on how to, you know, clean up the jawline a little bit, make it a little bit more, a little stronger. And yeah, it was really cool. It's a 3-inch bronze medal, and really, really an honor for me.
So did they just make one then for the president?
No, they give one to the president, and then they make and sell.
Okay.
And it's the best-selling medal of all time.
Interesting.
Yeah. Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Wow.
So that's exciting.
Trump bought 20 cases, 1,000 cases.
Yeah. It's, you know, he probably did. He was sending them out with his steaks, right?
Yeah.
You get one. The thing that's unique about that project is that it's against the law to depict a living person on a coin.
Really?
Like on a circulating coin.
How interesting. Okay.
So that law has been broken one time. So in this case, it's not a circulating coin, it's a medal. But it was interesting to me to have him select it rather than like a committee of people select it, right? That are not the actual subject. The only other time that's happened in history was the first spouse coin for Nancy Reagan. They had been waiting for first ladies to pass on as the legislation required, and then they would design the coin and their family would pick. And so for like Barbara Bush's coin, that was fun because the Bush family selected her portrait that I did of her, and so that was on the coin. For Nancy Reagan, she was hanging on, and they decided that the legislation was going to expire and that she was not going to get a coin. And because she wasn't going to get a coin, they weren't going to be able to do Barbara Bush's coin. She had already passed. And so they made an exception and let that design go forward. So Nancy Reagan actually selected her own portrait for her coin too, which was really fun. And when they went and unveiled it, she was watching, you know, on Zoom. So,
well, that would have been a huge loss if Nancy didn't get a coin. She
right?
was such an important part of that Reagan presidency.
Yeah. So
that's awesome.
It was a real honor and really a singular honor. It's never, like I said, it's never happened before. So it was really fun to have that one-to-one selection happen, which just doesn't happen very often.
And it's a beautiful coin. I've seen it. It's really pretty. It's really nicely done. So last question, if you'll humor us here. Who are your favorite artists, or who have you been most inspired by throughout your career?
This is a really hard question because there really are so many incredible artists, so many incredible living artists. To avoid offending my friends who I love and admire that are working right now by naming some and not others, for the brevity of time, I'll say I love the work of John Singer Sargent, who's a portrait artist from the end of the 19th century. His work is all over. So John Singer Sargent, he was a American artist that worked in Britain and did a lot of work there. And I also love the work of Alphonse Mucha, who is a Czech artist who inspired me because he did such beautiful design work, but he also did incredible murals depicting the history of the Slavic peoples. in a way that's just kind of overwhelming to contemplate. And I, both of these artists are inspired to me because they worked very commercially in the first part of their lives and then had a transition to more of their own passion projects. And it is someone who's on the verge of having to make that midlife crisis type decision about the work that I'm doing. I'm looking to them and their examples and deciding what kind of work I'm going to be spending the rest of my life doing, which I hope is deeply connected to my passion and who I am as an individual and those gifts that are unique to just me.
Ben, thank you.
Thank you for joining us today.
It's been a pleasure and an honor to spend time with you both. And I hope that the discussion we've had has been valuable.
Very much. Very much. We hope anyone listening here, with whether they're a student, parent, we hope policymakers and principals, you know, continue to see that they don't already know the value of art in their programs, in their education. And Ben, thanks for opening our eyes and understanding this at a deeper level. So thank you again for your time. Appreciate it. And Lindsay, as always, thank you for joining us in American Classroom.
If you like this episode, please like and share with someone who would find this interesting. We appreciate you listening to the American Classroom podcast today.
Thank you.
American Classroom is brought to you by Heritage Academy Mesa. Heritage Academy in Mesa, Arizona is a public charter school serving grades 7 through 12. Youth that come to Heritage are not just students, but scholars who are taught by the number one rated faculty in Arizona. If you'd like to learn more about Heritage Academy Mesa, please visit heritageacademyaz.com and click Mesa.